Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Brainwaves, hear the world differently. Bringing community mental health to you, raising awareness and challenging stigma. Tune in to 3CR Community Radio, Wednesdays at 5pm.
Melbourne's Drive Time Radio program, featuring community organisations, powerful stories and information. Find us at brainwaves.org.au. Proudly sponsored by Wellways Australia.
I would like to begin by paying my respects to the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, who are the traditional custodians of the land on which I am coming to you from today. Land where at Brainwaves we tell our stories, and land where the traditional custodians have told their stories for many, many years before us, and continue to tell their stories. I would like to pay my respects to elders past and present, and acknowledge all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners who are listening today.
In the introduction to his book, Neurospicy, where he sets out to explore and better understand himself in relation to ADHD and dyslexia, John O'Shea offers readers a warning. This book might seem all over the place, he writes. There's no clear beginning or end. It probably won't follow the structure of a typical book. And if that's a problem for you, I'd say stop reading now. Well, John O'Shea joins us on Brainwaves on 3CR this evening, so perhaps we should offer our listeners a similar warning. This interview may not follow the structure of a typical interview, but let's cross our fingers and hope for the best. Good evening, John, and welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to having a chat with you.
So I guess to start off, your book Neurospicy opens with the warning. Why did you feel that a warning was required?
Well, it was sort of a bit of tongue-in-cheek, but the real basis of it is I'm not a massive reader. I have written another book before when I was younger, but it's sort of not a space that I'm very comfortable with, and so I probably tried to protect myself a little bit by saying something like that. So it's more of an abstract dialogue of things that have happened to me in my life because of ADHD and dyslexia, and then how I translated those into either a positive outcome or they were a negative outcome. And which is one of the things that I really want to cover off today is, you know, being ADHD and dyslexic is fantastic. I couldn't think of anything better, but at the same time, it's also your kryptonite. So as much as it's a superpower, it's also something that you have to be very, very careful of. And it's not something that I would have wished on anyone up, you know, before the age of 18, just because of the struggles you had in the education system. But after that, not so much of a problem, but still very much a minefield that you have to work through. And whether that's you're the parent, you know, the partner or the person with it, brothers and sisters, you know, sharing a space with somebody that's a little bit neurospicy is always challenging. So it's not just the person that's struggling with it themselves personally, but it's also the surrounding people, which I think is important and probably not discussed enough.
Early in the book, you describe yourself as spicy. What does the word mean to you?
Well, it's probably quite a common phrase now, but when I was writing the book, it was sort of mentioned to me, you know, you've got a spicy brain, you know, it's got lots of flavour and lots of tangins to it, and it could leave a little bit of a bite, but at the same time is that it also was a lot easier to write the neurodiversity, you know, not being a great speller, so we sort of cut it down to neurospicy. And you know, it the book's sort of labeled Magic Madness, you know, the adventures of ADHD and dyslexia. So it's just the shorter way of being able to spell something which is, you know, dyslexia, I think I still spell, every time I write it, I still spell it differently. So
so I guess let's go all the way back to your school years. You were navigating undiagnosed dyslexia and ADHD at the time. How did that experience shape your education?
Yeah, look, the education system is probably difficult with anyone that's a little bit on the spectrum. It's really not trained to deal with people that have difficulties with English, which is dyslexia, difficulty with English, and ADHD being attention deficit and hyperactivity disorder. I guess both of those words put a label to it, but doesn't actually do anything to help fix it. And being dyslexic is difficulty with English, but it's such a small component of it. It really only covers a very, very small part of the overall experience of being dyslexic. You know, we think on multiple levels simultaneously. With ADHD, you have thousands of thoughts coming in. So you've got this dyslexic brain, which is thinking outside the box, very abstract, lateral thinking, problem solving, sees in pictures and colors and different sorts of shapes and sizes. And then you put the ADHD on top of that, which is just like a supercar with you know, an engine which is flat out, but it's got no brakes. And so that in any environment, be it work or sport or the classroom, can be very, very difficult to deal with. And so my experience at school was terrible. Every day was sort of a failure. And so I guess that's really something that people need to recognize as well, that, you know, we have people in the community that are so successful that are dyslexic or ADHD, and I think the statistics are roughly around 30 plus percent of entrepreneurs are dyslexic or ADHD. And you know, you can go from naming Richard Branson right through to actors, you know, all different diversified people. And then yet there's also these people that aren't recognized and aren't you know, household names, which deal with it every day as well. So yeah, school was a massive struggle for me and something which was negative and not a great experience.
You say being spicy is both a blessing and a curse. What are some of the gifts that come with it, and what are some of the difficult parts?
Yeah, look, the thought process of being able to see things that other people can't see, being able to see things in different shapes and colors and sizes, and like if we take something like, you know, reading a cookbook, something that I would struggle with, but to actually physically get involved with cooking a cake is fantastic, and then I'll never forget it. So the learning process is very, very different, and the way in which we look at things is very, very different. But that can also lead you into some of the negative traits of being ADHD or and or dyslexic, and that is you can very, very quickly get misled. You can very quickly go off tangent. You can find yourself completely miles away from where you should be, both in your thoughts and the process of those thoughts and where they've taken you. And so sometimes controlling that ADHD and dyslexic thought process is very, very important to learn how to do that and to learn to do it in a way which is not trying to stop it, but trying to be able to control it. A little bit like meditation. It's not telling you not to think, it's just telling you to quieten things down a little bit just for a period of time. And so those sorts of things make it sometimes very, very difficult with being ADHD and dyslexic that you do go off on tangents. You do find yourself in places, whether it's in your mind or physically, that you may not intended to be in. Now, that can also lead to a positive outcome if you pick up on the signs, but it also can be a negative outcome.
So you mentioned meditation before. Is that a part of something that you do to manage some of the difficult aspects?
I do it nearly every day. I've found that it's, you know, I've been on the Ritalin, I've done the drug side of it. I don't take it anymore. I find that the best solution for me is good diet, lots of sleep, and getting up in the morning before anything, a glass of water with some lemon squeezed in it. And I sit quietly for, you know, it might be 10 minutes, it might be 20 minutes. Today I did 28 minutes. I don't measure it and try and grade it because sometimes you just can't do it and you don't feel in the mood. And then I'll also go to the gym and I find that having a steam or a sauna at the end of my workout And I might even work out for 20 minutes or half an hour. I'm not talking about, being, a superstar, but just doing those basic things to start the day. I can run all day on that type of energy, in a more controlled manner. If I don't and I miss out on it, usually about five, the fifth day, I really feel myself going into this phase and this fog and not being clear, not being calm, overreacting to things that I normally wouldn't overreact to. So, yeah, but everyone has different ways of doing it. You can be skipping, juggling. I think anything that breaks your concentration, my partner goes for a run, and in that she's meditating, and I think any way that gets you to calm down, in your thought process is a positive start to the day.
I think some people really struggle with meditation. Is there any type of meditations that you turn to,
I
or?
did the Transcendental Meditation course here in Melbourne, and it's like a 2 day. It's not overly intensive, but look, the thing about it is the thoughts are not negative. It's just going back after you realize that you're in a thought. Instead of thinking, "Oh, I'm not meditating," you actually are. It's just that the thoughts snuck in. So it's a little bit like thinking about the water or the sea. If the waves on top are the thoughts and the calmness is underneath, then every time you feel the thoughts coming in, you just need to go back and find the calmness. And to do that, Transcendental Meditation is getting a small mantra. It's two words that don't mean anything, or one word that doesn't mean anything. But breathing is just as easy. By focusing on your breathing, like really deep, like 4 or 5 seconds in, hold it for 4 or 5 seconds, 4 or 5 seconds out. That will calm you down better than probably anything. I also have vibration music sometimes in the background, which is different vibrations because we're all connected, and sitting on the ground, so you're connected to the vibrations of the earth. That all helps. All these little things, but I don't do them religiously every day, the same thing. It's a bit like I often find myself when even I put my shoes and socks on, I don't do it the same way every day. Some people do. Some people put their right sock on, their right shoe on, the left, and so on. I'm always all over the shop. There's no pattern to it. And in fact, sometimes I walk out and there'll be different socks and one shoe won't have a sock. That's the ADHD and dyslexia part of it. But it's not to be negative about that. And that's what I've got to. I'm comfortable with the fact is these are going to be things that in my life, it's not going to be normal. It's not going to be on a train track. It's not going to be linear. It's going to be all over the shop, and to be comfortable with that.
So before you mentioned that your education, it was ongoing experience of failures for you as a young man and a child. There are some stories in the book about how your self-confidence was positively affected during your education years. One that stood out was the semester you spent at your school's mountain campus. What did that experience teach you about yourself?
Yeah, so you've got to imagine if you're going into an environment that every day you're failing. So it doesn't matter if it's maths or science or English. I got a little bit of comfort in sport and being outdoors. That was a lot more comfortable. But if you've still got that whole barrier, so you're getting on the bus, you're going to school, this is going to be, a day of failure. You go home, the school reports, your parents, your siblings, your friends, it all has a very, very negative approach to it. So you don't find a lot of spots in the world when you're younger to be comfortable. And yet we went on this camp, and that made me feel very comfortable. I was, there was not a lot of rules to the way in which you could operate. It was self-sufficiency in regards to, okay, well, you had to fill up your own water bottle, you had to put up your own tent. You had to keep yourself dry and hydrated and eat food, which you had to cook. That was in my element because that was a little bit lateral, where a lot of the kids that maybe were very, very good at school felt a little bit uncomfortable with that environment because it was outside of the norm. And so they were really positive experiences for me. And I continued that type of life on for a lot through my life. And I did outdoor education. I set up a camp called Wallangara, which is a non-for-profit organization, which has now 800 kids go through it. And we built that all out of recycled materials. So I did keep very much close to the bush and the outdoors, you know, skiing, rock climbing, all those sort of things. And my kids have also been very heavily involved with all that sort of side of life. So they're all major adventurers in different parts.
While you're, I'm not sure if you could remember this far back, but while you were attending that camp up on the mountain, did you encounter any of your, you know, your fellow students who did really well in the classroom struggle at the sort of this practical sort of outdoors sort of stuff and
Oh,
go,
totally.
okay, I think I've, you know, got,
Yeah.
I do have something on these, you know, these
Well,
more
yeah,
sort of
and
scholarly
probably
kids, you know.
because, you know, I think outdoor ed in its essence is there's sometimes a lot of little failures. You know, you don't light the fire straight away, you don't get the water boiled straight away. You know, there's, you know, you burn your hand when you're getting your food out of the fry pan. There's all those little bits, and sometimes they can mount up. Where if you're in a normal environment and the microwave and the fridge and you know you switch the heater comes on, you know the TV works and the school works all comfortable and you haven't had a lot of those little failures. Sometimes being put into the positions where there are lots of little bits of failure which really don't mount up to much, but over a whole day they can. You can get tired, fatigued, you know you're wet. You know, you're hungry, all of those sorts of things. I was very comfortable because I had a lot of failure through my journey of the education system. So this felt like very comfortable to me. And I think I write in the book about failure is sometimes a comfort blanket to me.
Yeah, I think I do have some questions to ask about that later in the interview. And another turning point was the Year 12 tertiary orientation program, which I believe it was a new program at the time that you were attending high school. What was that program and why did it make such a difference for you?
Yeah, well, I guess in fifth form, and I think they call that year 11 now, I'd failed every subject. And I was at a private school, and they were going to let me do a joint sort of year 11, year 12 program. And I didn't want to do that. And I write in the book, there's, you know, quite a funny anecdote that I write in the book about the dealing with the headmaster at the time. And I then chose to go to this tertiary orientation program, which was very new. And the reason that that was so successful for me was that only 50% of the mark was actually through exams, but the exams were during the year, so they weren't one exam at the end. And so you could get a little bit better each time, and so therefore it was a journey, and it was also then the journey of all your work that you did during the year as well. So if you put a lot of effort into it over a whole 12-month period, you could succeed. Instead of working over 12 months and then putting it all down to a 3 or 4 hour exam, which I would fail at naturally because I would be nervous. I knew that I couldn't spell the words properly. I couldn't get help and assistance, all of that. So the tertiary orientation program was a lot harder. Because it was over a whole 12 months. But for someone like me, it was so much more beneficial because I was prepared to put the work in. You know, I was never going to be the doctor or the engineer, and I was never going to go to that type of an exam. But I still was able to pass those subjects and be able to get into university, which I think was a, you know, a real blessing for me because then it set me on my way to university and to be able to do other things, which if I had gone through the normal traditional routine, then I would never have been able to get in.
You mentioned that your own kids didn't inherit these spicy traits that you mentioned. But given how common dyslexia and ADHD are, have other parents reached out to you with concerns about their own children?
Oh, look, yeah, I have. Often, and I'm very well known in the community as being an advocate for dyslexia and ADHD and seeing the positives of it and not the negatives. And it is difficult. especially for parents that are sitting there and their child is not keeping up with school, they're falling behind, they seem to be, stupid or not intelligent, which is completely the wrong way of approaching it. They're completely, it's the opposite. They're super intelligent. They're super lateral. They're really able to be creative and do all these things. They're just not fitting into the current medium of the way in which the education system grades you. That can be very daunting for parents. It can really be, well, why is it my other siblings are fine and this sibling really struggles with it? And I think that that's something that needs to be recognized, that the child's not broken. The child doesn't need to be fixed. There is nothing wrong with the child. It's just that it doesn't, the child does not learn in the same way that other children learn. And therefore, the success will come once you learn to teach them how to learn. And that's why they're very, people like myself are very good at being entrepreneurial, because you don't get a manual. You don't get, you do this, you do that, and step by step. If you're an accountant, you know that 1 + 1 = 2. And if you put all this together, then you get a spreadsheet and you do profit and loss. And it's very, very linear and structured. Where running the business is not linear and structured at all. You, 1 minute you're the accountant, the next minute you're the lawyer, you're the marketing genius, you're putting the rubbish out and you're making someone a coffee. And I think that that's an ADHD and dyslexic person's comfort zone, because they're able to multitask on multiple different levels and think of things in multiple different ways. And so therefore it becomes a comfortable space. So it is difficult for parents, it's difficult for siblings. I think it's also difficult for teachers, everyone surrounded these people, because they do think differently. But why is it they're really successful at this once they get older and not necessarily successful in the current education system? Is it the education system doesn't adhere to the way in which these people learn? And I think that's probably part of the problem, is that they learn differently, they receive information differently, so therefore it's got to be presented in a different way. And that's very difficult for a teacher that has spent their whole life successful in the system, goes back to the university, which is the same system, and then comes back into the education system to be a teacher. It's difficult for them to actually even understand why somebody would think differently.
You're very frank about anger being a part of your journey. You write that you would lash out and sometimes break things. Is being quick to anger something you think others with spicy brains can relate to?
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's on a multiple number of levels. I think there is actually a terminology that the educated would label us with. And there is that. But there's also the fact is, if you've continually been told that you're no good, you're very sensitive to criticism. And so that's the first point, that the environment that you've been in and you're surviving in is continually trying to, chip away at you. And so when you get into a position where you feel that you're being misunderstood, misrepresented, or that there is not justice in what's going on, you can be very, very quick to react. So I think there's both the chemical side of it in the ADHD and dyslexic person, more the ADHD than the dyslexic side of it. But then there's also the environmental things that have continually happened, that, you've been told you're a failure, you're no good, you're stupid, you can't do this. And so when you get to something and someone is critical, you can be very quick to react. And I can tell you, and I think you're going to ask the question, when I was coming back from Hawaii, I got thrown in jail just purely because of that situation. I was filling in an immigration card. I did it wrong. I asked for help. The lady that was the customs lady was not impressed to have to help me. And when she handed it back, she said, "My 4-year-old son could fill this in better than you." Well, I exploded. It just naturally just exploded. I said, "How dare, And so we got in this massive fight, a fight I was never going to win. And I got locked up. But, there was also an enormous amount of passion in me and why I was reacting the way I was reacting. It's years and years of, and then it was a written word. It was the red ink on it. It was, "You're a failure, and my 4-year-old son could do it better." It was not her fault for saying that. It was inappropriate, and she shouldn't have said it. But it was definitely my fault the way I reacted. And that's something that, has really resonated with me. And yes, you can be very, very quick to react because of the stigma that's been associated with being a little bit spicy over the years.
That experience in Hawaii led you to meet someone by the name of Jenny Dalton.
Yep.
How did that lead to you meeting this person? And who is Jenny Dalton, and what role did she play in your
Yeah,
growth?
Jen was amazing. So I was sitting in a mate's kitchen, and his mum was a librarian and lovely lady. She's passed now, but an amazing lady. And I told her the story about Hawaii, and she said, "John, you can't do that." I was at that stage. I was about 22, 23. I was successful. I'd just come back from a ski trip. I'd paid for myself. I was, I had a car, I had a house. I was being, I was really going places, but I still couldn't read and write. So I met Jenny, and she basically was doing a whole lot of stuff with kinesiology and natural learning and learning by doing and understanding it. So I said to her, "Look, if we're going to do the same stuff that I've done in school, where it's to slow it down and AEIOU and all this sounding and all this sort of stuff, I'm not interested because it doesn't work. Not for me, it doesn't work." And she said, No, we're not going to do that." And she said, "Oh, look, can you describe what it's like to go skiing?" And so I described skiing. She said, "That's fantastic. Can you describe skiing in a whiteout?" And I said, "Yeah," I described it and everything. She said, "All right, now describe hanging off a chairlift by one arm." I couldn't describe it. I just couldn't describe it. And she goes, "Well, you learn by doing. So you have to have physically done it for it to actually resonate with you. So you're a learner by doing. So what we're going to do is we're going to teach you to learn the words by doing them. So you're not going to learn phone box by phone, because that makes no sense to you. You're going to visualize the phone box. You're going to actually pick up the phone, and you're going to look at it, and that is just going to look like these words. It's not going to have any sounding to it. It's going to have no logic to it whatsoever. So you're practically going to do it." And that's what we did. And so my first 100 words was learnt by visualizing the word as what it really was. So book was looking at a book. I had no concept of the letters BOOK. They just became the visual stimulus of that book or cake or phone box or whatever it was. And from that, we started building out a library of words, which I would use regularly, and they just became natural. And now I'm probably 80% efficient at reading. I still write terribly. I still make words up, that I think that are close. ChatGPT is my friend. I don't send anything these days without ChatGPT. I sent you an email. You probably didn't even realize that, that had gone through a system. So, but back in the day, there was none of that available. And so it was red ink, failure, failure, failure. So, it's an interesting journey that was.
You have some strong ideas about how young neurodivergent people could learn differently and more efficiently. Can you unpack some of the ideas for us?
Well, I think firstly is recognizing that you have strengths. And I think that that's sometimes difficult, especially at a young age. Why is it that I can learn something, but I can't learn reading and writing or whatever it may be, maths or whatever it may do? And recognizing that if you can do something, if you can put your shoes and socks on and learn to do that, then you can pretty much learn to do a lot of stuff. And so it's just building the blocks off that. And then recognizing your strengths and then also appreciating your weaknesses. The one thing, though, is really important is to study it. If you study and understand and read books through audio tapes or wherever it may be, and actually understand why your brain is thinking the way it's thinking and the way in which it's working. So, if we, for an example, were good at music, okay, well, you would go to extra music class, okay? You'd go to music class after school, whatever. But doesn't mean that you can read music. You may play by ear. You may play the trumpet. You may play the drums. You may play guitar. Doesn't mean you can play them all. Well, I think that that is the way in which dyslexic and ADHD people should think of their learning process. Don't be negative that you don't learn it, that you can't read the music, but you may be able to play it, that you may be able to play the drums, but not the trumpet. And that is the way in which I have really looked at it and saying, well, why can I do this really well, but I can't do that? How can I apply that learning process to this and then actually trying to redesign the way in which I learn that? That's one way. The other way is having fitness, meditation, learning to juggle, learning to skip, all of these things that stop your brain from thinking or cross-pollinating with each side are really, really important because it calms you down. It allows you to have that little bit of quiet time. Because you've got to understand, we don't even sleep with relaxation. Like everyone, we're hyper. We're hyper from the morning. So we wake up tired. We go to bed tired, right? If you can go to bed and you can actually get to sleep. So you're running on a very, very empty tank the whole time, and there's lots of pressures coming in, and there's so much thought processes going on. To be able to understand it, to educate yourself about it, to learn how to calm yourself down are all really, really positive things. And then see, why is it that I can do this? I can't do that. How can I cross-pollinate it across? And I think a lot of the time there's all these books about, oh, write out these lists and do this and do that. I'm never going to write. If I write the list out, I'll write it out once and I'll never look at it ever again. Well, that's my strength and my weakness. You see that that's it's a difficult thing to sort of look at it from the outside, but it's understanding you. And if we all have a different levels of it. So my ADHD and dyslexia are on very high. If we were going to 1 to 10, I'm probably on an 8 on both of them. Some people will only be dyslexic, but they'll only be marginally dyslexic. They'll only be a 3. So everyone's at a different sort of level. And that's why I think applying it to something like music makes sense because it is so varied. And yet that seems to be acceptable. Yet being ADHD and dyslexic is sometimes acceptable and sometimes not.
This might give you an opportunity to give sort of a practical sort of unpack that, how that might look like, how that might look practically. While your son doesn't have ADHD or dyslexia, but he did struggle at school for a while. One suggestion from the school that he was attending was to incorporate subjects he was passionate about into his learning. That really resonated with you. So why did that sort of resonate with you at the time?
So we had packed the kids up and we'd moved to Bali for a year to take them to a school called the Green School. And if anyone wants to see how the education system can work, look up the Green School in Indonesia. It's amazing. It was like school on steroids. It was really fantastic. It was short learning programs. It was learning to be a successful person, a good community leader, environmentally sound, and a business sort of approach to life. And it was really, really good. But my second oldest was struggling a little bit. Loved his surfing, had got into the surfing. So we ended up pulling him out of the green school, even though we loved it, and we set up a school specifically dedicated to surfing. Now that means maths, science, English, everything had to be related to surfing. Now you sit there and go, well, how can you do that? Well, initially I was a bit skeptical too, but we hired a windsurfing instructor that was a school teacher. And the things that we came up with, well, he came up with and we sort of worked together on it, was things like, okay, if you want to design a surfboard, you need mass, you need buoyancy, you need shaping, so you need physical skills. There's all this stuff that mathematically went into it. And then if you wanted to work out how many paddle strokes from one beach to another beach or one point to another beach, you could mathematically work it out, but then they could practically go and test it. When you're at the beach, they were working out about the environment. They were, studying waves. They were studying. When he did a year, by the time the year was finished, we had 6 kids in that surf school. So they'd get up in the morning at 6 o'clock, go surfing. The gym was around surfing. They had video, so they were learning how to be, videographers. They were doing editing, all of his stuff all around surfing. And when he went back to the Green School before we came back to Melbourne, Australia, he went back into the system and he hadn't missed a beat. Absolutely hadn't missed a beat. Hadn't read some of the subjects or the books that were related to English, but he had no trouble whatsoever of dovetailing back in. And so getting something passionate that you're interested in, as we all know, you can sit for hours playing a video game. You can sit for hours doing a jigsaw if that's what you're into, or some people reading. You just get lost in that world. Well, he got lost in education. And it was amazing to have that experience and to watch that journey. And these six other kids that were not necessarily seen as being the brightest kids in the school actually were excelling when they went back.
You also place a lot of emphasis on business skills, even suggesting CEO style development in curriculums designed for neurodiverse students. Why do you think business leadership is such a strong fit for dyslexic and ADHD thinkers?
Well, if we look at the success of those types of people and where they end up, it would seem logical that if they were to approach their education system in the same way, it would probably fit in. You don't, as a CEO or somebody that's leading your own journey in life, you don't get a bell to tell you to stop to eat. You don't have necessarily deadlines. You work to succeeding in a goal, an aim, and a project. And I think running things as a project makes so much more sense to our brain because there's a thousand things that need to happen to make that project work. Where we're taught in a very linear, vertical manner that you do this step, then that step, and then this step. Where my brain's already 5 steps ahead, I've missed 4 steps, but I know I've got to come back to them. But why do I have to do them in that logical order when I can sometimes, Tarantino did movies backwards and sideways and everything, but still told the story. You got the story, you just didn't get it all in a linear format. Well, I think that the education system, as in business, could do the same thing. As long as you end up at the end with the same goal, the journey can be chopped and changed and split up. And so, therefore, modular units with no start and no end, I think would really suit our sort of brain process. And eventually it all just locks together at the end once you've got a solution, and which is solving problems, business type of mentality to it.
You've been involved in numerous business ventures yourself. In what ways has dyslexia and ADHD actually been assets in that world for you personally?
Well, I think the business projects that I've been involved with have all been outside of the box. They've not been normal. And because looking at those processes differently were part of the success in what I had. So when I first wrote my book, after being locked up in Hawaii, Jenny and I wrote a book together, and that was Dyslexia, How Do We Learn? I was really disappointed with that book, and I wanted to make it into an animation film. I took that to Richard Pratt, which is the owner of Visy Industries, passed now. And Richard said, "I love your concept, but I don't really care much for dyslexia. Can you do it for a Can you do it for the environment?" And within a second, I'd said yes. We'd come up with a budget. He funded me, and I developed a thing called Ollie Recycles, which is still in schools today. And that's that. Dyslexic ADHD sort of mentality is, yeah, I came in this door, but someone gave me this door and I went straight through it and I accepted it. Where a lot of people that learn linear would go, oh no, I'm just going to stick to what I want to do and I'm just going to stay on this journey. And so those opportunities continually happened through my life. I was a nurse in the UK, not qualified to be a nurse. But I read the job interview completely wrong. And I ended up working for Mike Nemisferi, who was the ex-British ski champion of the world and was the James Bond stuntman doing all the ski things, but he broke his neck at C4. I thought he was a 12-year-old and I was going to take him on his adventures. He was 26, I was 24. We became great friends, and I became his personal nurse, and we traveled all around the world together. So those opportunities wouldn't have come about if I hadn't have read the ad wrong, and then hadn't had the, the spicy brain to go, yeah, I can do that. Why can't I be a nurse with no qualifications?
You talk about becoming quite resilient in the face of failure, because it, it was just an experience of your life. Fearless almost, due to experiencing so much of it. But you describe that as another blessing and curse. How has failure shaped your relationship with risk over the years?
Yeah, well, it has been. It's sort of this is where the superpower and the kryptonite get really, really entangled, and that is that I'm very comfortable with failure. I don't recommend it, but at the same time, it's very, very important. And your success is really, I believe, is the foundation of your failures. If you're successful the whole time, that's great, and I wish you all the best of luck. I've not met many people that haven't done a lot of failing to get to the points of their success. And I think it's almost imperative. But it's also very difficult to deal with failure. But in my world, I've had a lot of experience with it. But then that sometimes could be too comfortable. And so instead of recognizing the blaring flames that are burning around you and saying, don't go this way, it's not the right way to go, you actually continue on down that path and find yourself falling into a crevasse, falling into, a disastrous situation. The business doesn't survive. You've got financial pressure on you because you haven't been picking up the signs. And so that sometimes can be a negative where, and that's where I call it the kryptonite. So you've got this amazing resilience, this ability to be able to barge through when other people would give up. You don't mind the uncomfortable feelings. You see things laterally. You're there before other people get there, but then sometimes you can just go off on a tangent and you find yourself down this massive crevasse. And how did I get here? And oh shit. And then you spend the next, year and a half trying to climb out of it. And that's that ADHD, dyslexia, what I call the kryptonite of the superpower.
There's a very revealing section in the book about your separation after 30 years of marriage. You write, "I hate being spicy and know that it has caused this damage." From your perspective, how can spicy brains struggle in relationships and why?
Oh yeah, it's probably I think the number one issue that spicy people have is dealing with other non-spicy people, and it's a very, very much a roller coaster for them. And my heart goes out to everyone that's a partner or a parent or sibling of somebody that's spicy like myself. Not being negative to the spicy person at all. It is just a roller coaster. And it is, one minute this is happening and everything's successful, the next minute there's complete disaster and failure. And that, you're not settling down with an accountant or a financial planner or an engineer. You're settling down with somebody which is abstract, it's all over the shop, it's going to be amazingly exciting. And it's going to be amazingly non-exciting. And that roller coaster, it can be very, very wearing. And I think that needs to be recognized that we don't see it. We don't see that roller coaster at all. It just seems very natural to us. And it's almost comfortable for us. If it was very linear and boring and straight, we'll just turn off. And that's why they say that we get distracted easy or we don't focus. It's just because we're not interested. And so we just turn off. Where that brain process is when you are interested, you've been going 1,000 miles an hour in 1,000 different directions. And that can become very, very difficult for your partner or people around you. Let's go basic example. You're given a list of things to go to the supermarket and you come back with half of them. They're all the wrong label. There's nothing that you've had in the fridge for the last 20 years. And no one likes what you've got. And so you've unbalance the environment in a way, you're just going, well, it's cheese, it's milk, it doesn't matter. You know, what's the difference? And so that's a little spectrum. Imagine that every day. It can be very, very wearing. It can be very daunting. It can be, well, you don't concentrate. You don't show any appreciation. You're not focusing. You're, always distracted and all this sort of stuff. On the outside, that's what seems like is happening. On the inside, it's not like that at all.
After your divorce, you joined a men's group where you learned about having the heart of a servant. What does it mean to have a servant's heart?
Yeah, this was a, and I don't think this is necessarily a dyslexic or an ADHD thing. It's probably more of a male's trait than anything, and that is that, everyone's looking for a little bit of a pat in the back, or look what I've done. I've taken the rubbish out, or I've done the dishes, or I've made the bed, and I've done those sorts of things. And aren't I great? I'm earning this amount of money, and aren't I successful? So therefore, I should get a free pass. The heart of the servant is really about saying you can do all of those things, but you don't need any thanks for it, no gratitude, and you do it because you feel that you need to do it because it's part of what you want to be able to instill onto your partner. And I think that that was a very big learning curve for me. And I think that being Neo Spicy, I had sacrificed a lot of that love and passion through the energy that I thought I was giving in other ways. And so therefore, that became tiresome and weary as well. So once I changed and thought about every time I did something, was I doing it for myself to get some recognition, or was I doing it because I really just wanted to do it? And I think that's it's a difficult thing sometimes, especially for a male, to get over that barrier that it's okay just to do it and not ask for anything in return and not expect anything in return. That's a really difficult thing, and that's really helped me a lot later in life. I'm very late to learn that, very late.
Well, yeah, why do you feel that it took so long to for that lesson to land?
Well, maybe I was never taught it. Maybe I never recognized that it was something that was happening. Yet I would do things for the kids and have no qualms whatsoever, never ask for anything, and even with my partner. But the fact is that there were times when you were expecting, gratitude, and you were doing things and justifying it because, oh, okay, look what I've done over here, and all that sort of stuff, and we're going on these amazing holidays or amazing adventures. And yeah, heart of the servant is a difficult one, and I th but it's a very nice spot to be in when you can get there, and I still have to concentrate on it a lot.
So, for people listening, especially those from your generation, who may not have had, the language we have today or diagnosis, growing up, what would you say to someone who suspects they might be, dyslexic or have ADHD?
Well, there's lots of testings now, and there's lots of available information around it. I think not to be scared of it. Getting a label on it doesn't do anything. It may help the people around you to explain the fact is, okay, now we know why it's a little bit abstract, a little bit out there. But it doesn't do anything for you as the individual with it. And so that education is really important. But yeah, go and get your diagnosis, go and do the test. It's not easy to get tested these days. Probably a lot easier if you're younger, but for older people, it's very difficult to get in, to even find a psychiatrist. I think I was diagnosed with ADHD at the age of 56. I knew I always was, but I just didn't want to get on that bandwagon. But it took me around about 8 months to get my first appointment. And it was, so it's not going to happen straight away. And you probably know in your own heart, but if you read up about it and you study about it, you can pretty much work it out yourself. And because that's one thing, ADHD and dyslexic people, we aren't stupid. We just need the information, and then we can process it very, very fast. And with audiobooks these days, there's so much available. You can reach out to me on my website. That's always possible, and have a chat there. And yeah, so I'm very much a supportive of seeing the positives with it, because it really is. We've got so, NASA employee, I think it's 30 to 40% of its employees are dyslexic. Why? Because they don't want the normal. They want people that are abstract, because going into outer space is not normal. There's no road up there, so you need to have this alternative thinking process. Why entrepreneurs, majority of them are dyslexic or ADHD? It's again because they're thinking outside the box. So if we can get that positive thing to it, it's actually a blessing. Just after 18 or 20, the early teen, because school is, it's a nightmare. I wouldn't wish it on anyone.
And I guess finally, you mentioned that people can reach out to you if they have any questions. Where can people find more about more information about you, and where can they themselves get a copy of your book, Neurospicy?
Yeah, so it's neurospicy.life. So it's NEURO spicy, which is SPICY dot life. Yeah, they can go there. No, there's a code there. You happy for me to mention a discount code? Yeah, so there's a code ABC25. So that was probably as easy as I could do. I designed it on the 2025 and ABC. I thought it couldn't be any simpler than that. So that's the code. There's a discount there. I actually can't remember what the discount is, whether it's 15, 20, or 25%, but there's a discount there, and it just ships straight to your door. But there's also a spot on the website where you can actually add your own story. And so what I'm going to try and do is get a collective of stories together, like 10 to 20 stories of other people's journeys, and then publish that book, and then all the royalties of those sales will go back to the individuals that contributed to the book. So there's a space in there for people to be able to write their own, little anecdotes down, and see if we can't get a few more abstract stories out there than just my own.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for joining us today, John. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I hope you might want to join us again once that book is published of the other anecdotes by
Yeah,
other
well,
people's experiences.
it might be a while away, but you never do know.
All right, thank you so much. You have a good day.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.